should have bariatric surgery.
Discussing life expectancy in patients with advanced cancer.
How low should we go with blood pressure in the elderly?
And salt intake of people with chronic kidney disease.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on May 27th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should turn right to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This ongoing issue, somehow I don't think we can quite get enough of it. That's this idea of blood pressure management in elderly people. I said, how low should we go?
And since 75% of persons older than 75 years have hypertension or high blood pressure, this really is an important issue. And there have been some conflicting guidelines. We know that in general, having a lower blood pressure up to a point can actually reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. But if you get it too low and you have the risk of hypotension or low blood pressure, which can be particularly problematic in the older individuals. So what these investigators attempted to do was they looked at a subset of a national multicenter randomized clinical trial called SPRINT, the Systolic Blood Pressure Intervention Trial. And they specifically tried to make sure that this population was enriched with individuals over the age of 75. And they randomized those individuals to get a blood pressure below 140 or to target a blood pressure of 120. And the group had a total of about 2,600 patients. And they looked at the outcome that was primarily cardiovascular disease. Did they have either a heart attack, a stroke, or heart failure? And here's what they discovered. Of the individuals, about 80 years old, about 40% women, followed for a mean of about 3 years, the intensive group, targeting 120, had significantly less cardiovascular events. It reduced them by about 33 or 34%. Now you might ask, what about the downside? Were there more serious adverse events? And the answer is no. There was a modest increase in the risk of having renal dysfunction, but really no significant difference in hypotension or other serious issues. So it looks like in individuals over the age of 75, we should be targeting a blood pressure of 120 rather than 140.
Couple questions here. One is, how many agents did it take to get it down to 120? Because as we're aware, often it takes more than one.
Those that had the more intensive therapy required one more additional medication than the other group. So that's a great question.
The total number was in the group that had the 120 target?
On average, Elizabeth, these individuals would be taking two or three medications.
So I guess that's one concern I have. That's the polypharmacy. And then were there any quality of life measures? Because again, as we're aware, what people complain of when they're on all of these agents for lowering their blood pressure is they just don't feel good.
There was no difference in the side effects between the two different types of treatment.
And then finally, here's my last question. What about falls? Did they take a look at fall incidents in these two groups?
Well, they looked specifically at syncope, that is having such severe dizziness that you actually passed out. And there was no difference between the groups. Somewhere between 2.5% and 3% of individuals would experience that complication, regardless of which therapy they were prescribed.
We're seeing that there's burgeoning evidence suggesting that we really ought to target a lower systolic blood pressure in this group of people. I guess I would just like to see some long-term examination of these other aspects of treatment.
This was a short-term study. It was a 3-year study. But the fact that there was no significant difference in falls or syncope or electrolyte abnormality or acute kidney or renal failure in this large patient population, still pretty convincing.
Well, if you're convinced, I'm convinced. Since we're in the Journal of the American Medical Association, let's turn to this other issue, and that's sodium and kidney disease.
It says kidney disease affects 11% of the U.S. population, and it's associated with things like cardiovascular disease and even mortality. It's an important issue. Related to that is, are there things that we do that actually can exacerbate the complications of kidney disease, and in particular with regard to our diet and salt? There's been a lot of controversy about whether salt intake increases the risk of things like hypertension. I think that that data is pretty convincing. But does it increase the risk of cardiovascular disease? But in individuals that are at an increased risk, that is with chronic kidney disease, does salt potentially make things worse? So the investigators looked at a prospective cohort of patients that had chronic kidney disease, and they enrolled them in a study that followed them. These these individuals had three serial determinations of salt intake, not by recording their diet, but actually measuring it in the urine. So pretty accurate. And then they correlated their risk of having cardiovascular events every 6 months for a duration of about 7 years to see if there was a correlation between salt intake and one of these events. Well, among the almost 3,800 patients followed for 7 years, when they looked at the different quartiles of salt ingestion, the highest one was associated with a significantly increased risk of having one of these cardiovascular outcomes. The one that was more common was heart failure.
So in your estimation then, what's the clinical utility of this finding?
It suggests that even a modest decrease in salt could substantially decrease the risk of cardiovascular events in people with chronic kidney disease. The highest group took on average of about 45 to 5,000 milligrams per day. That's about 5 teaspoons of salt, versus the lowest group had less than 2 teaspoons. I think decreasing salt intake has implications with regard to how these people do.
In people with chronic kidney disease. Alternatively, I would reflect that some of the other literature, things that we're not talking about this week, was taking a look at salt consumption in people who are normotensive and who also don't have kidney disease, and finding something that's slightly contrary.
Exactly. And that's why I say, in people that don't have kidney disease, it's not clear yet that there's an association between salt intake and cardiovascular events. In this study, it seems very clear. And by the way, this was irrespective of the blood pressure. So it wasn't that the increased salt increased blood pressure that increases. There was some other factor that wasn't identified in this trial.
And I find this really fascinating because we've talked about salt as the Darth Vader of the diet and then the contrary information or the conflicting information that came out. So this might help us to understand better some of the physiology of it.
Exactly. And the other thing that's really nice about this study is the rigor with which it was performed. This actually measured it in the urine in successive times. So this is one of the more rigorous studies we've looked at.
Outstanding. Let's turn now to the Journal of Clinical Oncology, something I find rather concerning, that in people with advanced cancer, what are we really telling them as their disease advances?
We've talked before about how important it is to make sure that the patients have as much information as possible so they can make informed decisions. And that's really important in people that have advanced cancer. What this study did was examine discussions of life expectancy. How frequently were they done, and were the patients informed? Did they really have the correct information? So they looked at 178 patients, and they asked them, did they know they had a terminal disease? Did they know that treatment wasn't going to help? Did they know, for example, that their life expectancy was months as opposed to years? And they did this before they talked to the physician and after they talked with the physician. What they discovered was that those that had recent discussions with their physicians really had a better handle. In total, of the whole group, only 5% could answer all the questions correctly. But those that had recent discussions were more likely to do so than those that had discussions in the past. How often did that happen? Only about a fourth of the time was there a recent discussion based upon recent testing.
In my experience in observing these kinds of interactions, sometimes the physician speaks in like what I call medicalese or doctor speak, and the patient is so vested in what they don't want to hear that they don't really pay attention. So I think that there's an issue on both sides.
And I think that point's well taken. I mean, I don't want to put this on the physician or the patient. It's really both. But what this highlights is, this didn't talk at all about the quality of the discussion. It was just how recently was it held. My response to you is, you're right. The patient oftentimes has to be told the same information multiple times because they only get a sliver of it each time.
And this is, again, from the filter of the assumptions that I have. But I think if patients were fully aware of how advanced their disease is, they probably wouldn't be selecting additional treatments at that point that are likely to result in considerable morbidity and really don't have much in the way of upside.
Absolutely. This is a time where you explain to the patient where their disease stands so that it can really influence the quality of life.
Exactly. Finally, let's turn to diabetes care. A look at expanding the indications for bariatric surgery.
There are guidelines that have to do not with bariatric surgery for the use of treating obesity, but surgery to treat diabetes. And they're changing the name of it. They're suggesting it not be called bariatric surgery, but actually metabolic surgery. It changes many of the metabolic complications of obesity, specifically diabetes, and it affects hypertension as well. The interesting thing about this, there were over 46 different organizations that signed on to this document.
what's a little concerning about this expansion of indications is, gosh, how many more people are going to be candidates for this kind of surgery? And then what kind of surgery are they recommending? Because as we're aware, there are several different types of surgery that strategize to get people to a place of weight loss or diabetes control.
The nice thing about this particular article, it's the most extensive document to date that looks at all the information. I'm going to suggest we put this in our blog and let the readers go through it. The data look like it's cost effective, believe it or not. This paradigm shift from calling it bariatric or obesity surgery to metabolic surgery is a big shift.
Okay. On that note, you've already said what I'm going to do on the blog will be the bariatric or metabolic surgery. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.